Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Welcome to the Bike Radar Podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar Podcast. I'm Jack Luke, the deputy editor at BikeRadar.com, and today I am joined by my beautiful colleagues, Tom Marvin, senior technical editor across Bike Radar and Mountain Biking UK.
I've had a promotion.
Have
great.
You?
Not senior yet, but
I thought you were a senior tech editor. Well, I'm sorry, Tom.
I haven't been told it, but I'm hoping I will be soon.
All right. Yeah. Well, there you go. A little spoiler alert that I didn't even know about.
Tom's manager's listening.
And then I'm also joined by senior tech writer, for sure, I hope, Simon Von Bromley, who's joining us remotely today. Tom Marvin, how are you today and what have you been up to?
I am okay today, thank you, Jack. I have been up to visiting Tailfin, my friends there, and going to Cotswold Outdoors and buying some camping kit because I'm going camping soon and I needed some bits and pieces.
Going camping for a very extended period?
I am. I'm going camping for 6 weeks.
You're going to be very sick of sleeping mats by the end of that.
I hate camping.
Yeah.
I haven't even left yet and I hate camping.
Simon Von Bromley, big fan of Egyptian cotton sheets. How do you feel about the idea of 6 weeks of camping and how are you today?
I would never do that, yeah. Like when Tom's sitting there joking that he hates camping, like I actually hate camping and wouldn't ever dream of doing it. You know, even the idea of a kind of festival camping is a turn off to me. So yeah, you know, all fine here. I've been testing a lot of expensive road bikes for the kind of bike of the year recently, which has been very fun. And you know, testing a lot of £6,000 to £8,000 bikes. They're all very good.
In good weather as well.
£6,000 to £8,000 bikes, they've all been very good, have they?
Yeah.
Shocker.
Who could have predicted it? Speaking of festivals, we've had a bit of a fiesta of cycling news across, thank you very much, cycling news across Bike Radar in recent weeks. It has been, you know, this will mean very little to the listeners, but from a sort of news hound perspective, it's been a bit bonkers on site and we've barely been able to keep up with the cadence of new products that have been launched. So
as you'll probably find out when we start talking about these new products.
But today we're going to bring you we'll call it 4.5 highlights from the last couple weeks across gravel cycling, road bikes and mountain biking. Some key stories, and kicking things off, we're going to go into the 2022 Cannondale Topstone Carbon, which has been lightly updated, we'll say, for the new season. Key updates include moving to a threaded bottom bracket, worth mentioning off the bat, because any mechanics listening probably won't be sad to see the back of PressFit 30, is it BB30 from Cannondale?
Yeah, it was PressFit 30.
PressFit 30. Maybe Simon, a big fan of PressFit bottom brackets, but I'm not going to get him started on that because this is only a short podcast. lightly updated geometry, new builds across the board, and something we're going to focus on for a little bit, just because I think it's quite interesting, a move away from Cannondale's asymmetric integration rear end, which previously saw the rear wheel dished off by 6 millimetres to the left?
To the right.
To the right. I can't remember. It's been so long.
The drivetrain was bought out by... The drivetrain was bought rightwards by 6.
Yes.
And then...
Wow, we sound so
basically you couldn't use... Basically, you couldn't use normal wheels. You had to use wheels with a specific dish for this bike.
Yes.
Which don't really exist.
No.
But it did. I mean, it made sense in some respects because it meant...
Before we say why it made sense.
The problem is availability rather than whether it's a bad or a good idea. Yeah.
So anyway, we've moved away from that on Cannondale, which, as Simon alluded to there, is probably a good thing, I think, because it does just mean if you already have a set of wheels, then you can slap them straight onto this bike. And redishing a set of wheels is usually possible for the most part, maybe not the most mechanically best thing you can do from a wheel building perspective, but nonetheless, it was possible. But for me, threaded bottom brackets, normal dished wheels, that all hints towards, I would say, for Cannondale as a brand who historically haven't been afraid of proprietary designs, maybe a bit of a recalibration in their thinking there. And you've arguably seen that a little bit on the road bike side as well with their particular interpretation of aero cockpits, where, yes, it is a sort of unique design to them, but it is much, much more adaptable than a typical one-piece cockpit. But the bikes are also designed to also run with a typical two-piece cockpit. What do you think, Simon?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of on the same ballpark as you, Jack. I think it's broadly a good idea simply because, yes, it's possible, you know, if you had a wheel set that you were desperate to use in this new bike, you could redish it to fit, mm-hmm. you know, the top stone potentially. But then that also means it's no longer compatible with the bike you just took it off as well. So, you know, if you... Then again, yeah, if you get another bike in the future, or even if you, you know, have multiple bikes and you're just kind of swapping wheels between to swap tire, you know, it becomes a bit of a faff. And I agree with Tom that there are some good engineering decisions behind it. You know, it meant that you could have, you know, short chain stays and lots of tire clearance, you know, which is great. But I'm not entirely convinced that, you know, redishing wheels just to save, you know, a few millimeters on chain stay length is worth it for the majority of people. So I kind of agree with you. I think it's generally a good step. And it's the same with, you know, the bottom bracket thing. You alluded to earlier that, you know, on paper, I kind of am of the opinion that press fit bottom brackets, you know, they're kind of lighter, stiffer, all of that sort of stuff. But I guess for, you know, a kind of gravel bike where, you know, there's lots of mud involved, lots of sand involved, lots of, you know, grit and things like that, then, you know, if you're going to be having to change the bottom bracket bearings out more frequently, then it is certainly easier for a home mechanic who doesn't have, you know, bearing presses and all of that sort of stuff to deal with a threaded bottom bracket. And I know that, yeah, it's a kind of minority opinion that press fit bottom brackets are better.
An extremist opinion, one might say. On the subject of sort of integration, Cannondale has also introduced its Smart Sense system onto the Topstone. Now, we saw this about 2 months ago, I reckon it would be, mm-hmm. with the Synapse. And essentially, it's an integrated lighting and rear view radar system, which uses an integrated battery pack that slots into the down tube of the Topstone and also the Synapse. And it's quite a neat design on paper. Personally, I'm not like hugely sold on it as a concept. The idea of separate accessories doesn't really offend me, but you know, for some people I do get it. Maybe I'm just coming from perspective of being picky. What do you think, Tom?
I think from as someone who frequently forgets to charge electronic devices, having just one big electronic device, as it effectively is, to charge is maybe a little bit easier, but at the same time it ties you into things that you might not necessarily really want. Like, I like to pick and choose my lights, and I mean, I don't ride a radar system, but my lights, does it plug into GPS as well, keep that charged maybe? You know, like, I'm one for picking and choosing the bits I really want, not being picked and chosen for by... by someone in North America.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, to be fair, like, they used, you know, the Garmin radar type ecosystem, and I think it was Lazine lights, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, this is all good stuff.
What do you think, Jack? You've used a Garmin radar, haven't you?
Yes, I actually really like it. It very much depends on the type of riding you're doing. For urban riding or busier roads, it's useless. It's actually really annoying more than anything else because, you know, like, that awareness you should just have anyway. And if there's so much traffic, it doesn't really matter if it's telling you a car's approaching because there just will be.
There's always cars approaching.
Exactly.
But that's not a problem for a gravel bike, is it?
No, but on a gravel bike or on quieter rural roads, I actually really like it. You know, I did find it noticed cars long before I did. And it wasn't too intrusive, but I can see why some people wouldn't necessarily like it. I would call it a win radar in general, but the interface on it, the kind of head unit side of things, was a bit annoying. But anyway, if you want to get the full scoop on the new Cannondale Topstone, including some very brief ride impressions from our very own Robin Furtado, head to bikeradar.com, where we have the full story there. It's a very, very good one. And we've also got a video on the YouTube channel. Now, the Cannondale Topstone was arguably one of the first mainstream gravel bikes to come with full suspension. We did have the Cannondale Slate some years before, but in terms of a full suspension layout, the Topstone definitely was one of the front runners there. But sticking with the subject of gravel suspension, we're going to go into the new Fox 32 Tapercrest Gravel Fork, which is the newest gravel fork from Fox Components. We previously saw their AX Adventure Fork, which, to be generous, was essentially a slimmed-down version of old mountain bike tech. Wasn't universally loved, had some quite strange spec choices, including a post-mount brake and boost spacing, maybe, Tom? No, it wasn't boost spacing.
No, it's 15 by 100, I think. But it was more like the crown was hit your down tube a little bit. And
yeah. It wasn't a particularly refined design, and it very, very much was.
I mean, it was a 32 that had been shrunk from 100 mil to 30 mil.
And that was pretty
much
it.
That was basically all they did.
Now, the 32 Tapercrest is totally different. Mm. It really is a proper, from the ground up, new gravel suspension fork. Its most distinctive feature is, as the name suggests, it's quite aggressively tapered lowers, which do really go down to like a point at the bottom. They have very pronounced sort of, what would you call it, weight reduction casting towards the bottom of the lowers. I
mean, imagine a RockShox Mag 21 from 20 years ago and colour it orange and put some gold stanchions on it. And
it is pretty much that. And it does look an awful lot like the old RockShox Ruby as well. Mm. And the fork does have more than a passing resemblance to the new RockShox
Rudy.
Rudy, yes, the Rudy, which is the newish gravel fork which launched last year. Tom, I'm going to go to you first. Mm-hmm. Simon, I'm sorry to say, you know, you are our go-fast aero boy. Tom, with his mountain bike knowledge, is probably best advised to comment on this. What do you think of the new fork? What are its key highlights? What do you think of gravel suspension? Give me your...
We'll start with the big question, gravel suspension. I am a fan. I think if rigid forks were meant to be faster and rigid bikes were meant to be faster, cross-country mountain biking would all be done on rigid bikes. And it's not. Everyone pretty much races most of the time on full suspension bikes, because if you have anything other than very smooth surfaces, suspension makes things faster. Even Formula One cars have suspension. So,
very good point. He's not wrong.
There's a bit of proof that I am not wrong. So the key aspects of the fork. So it's a 1.5 to 1.8 steerer tube only, and that has been cited because of supply chain issues with coronavirus. So if you don't have 1.5 to 1.8, you might be disappointed.
What would be the other alternative for most gravel riders out there, Tom?
Well, I mean, there are various other standards out there, which depends very much on the bike into which you may fit it.
No, I just wanted to kind of give you a little pop quiz on your steerer.
It's very kind of you. I appreciated that one. The other sort of notable feature, other than sort of its tapered legs, and which weirdly Fox apparently claimed does give you some aero benefits by... I call a little bit of wishful thinking on there, is the use of a reverse arch, similar to what Manitou currently do on their forks, similar to what Pace often did with their forks as well. And the idea of that is that because of the way like fork rakes work and all that sort of stuff, having an arch that is behind the two legs means it can be a little bit lower. It doesn't have to extend quite so high, which shaves weight. So that's helped bring the fork down to 1300 grams, which, you know, it's not like crazy light, but it's a touch, on our scales, it's a touch heavier than the RockShox Rudy. It's a bit heavier than the Lefty, and it's significantly heavier than the Grit.
Love
Grit fork, yeah. And yeah, it comes in three versions. You've got Performance, Performance Elite, and Factory. So the Factory is the whiz-bang, super posh one with the Grip 2 damper that is borrowed... Oh, sorry, Fit 4 damper, borrowed from the Fox 32 mountain bike fork, with Kashima-coated stanchions. So that's a gold... stanchion, which has micro pores in it, which is said to have lower friction. The Performance Elite fork gets the same internals, but with a non-gold suspension stanchions, and the Performance one gets the basic Grip damper, which is my damper of choice.
Is it now?
Yeah, I give me a fork. Okay, on the mountain bike side of things, give me a Grip 2 fork or a Grip fork, and for the middle of the bell curve rider, I would argue that the Grip damper is better.
Well, there we go.
There we go.
For the benefit of our gravelly listeners, you know, how different is the tune, and I guess actually physically, how different are these dampers to those seen on the mountain bikes?
I don't think they're going to be massively different. I think the Fit4 damper will be sort of transposed pretty much straight over from the 32. I believe the 32 TC has those 32 millimeter diameter stanchions.
This is the Fox's cross country mountain bike fork.
Yes, the Fox 32. Well, the Fox 32 is the XC fork, and the 32 TC is a gravel fork. Same diameter stanchions, so internally they're going to have the same internal sort of shape and size. So it will be the same damper. I'd be pretty much sure of that, with a very similar but shortened air spring. I think they say that it doesn't need so many tokens, so air spring tokens in there, so it should be a little bit more controlled with less travel than the Fox AX, which required a lot of tokens in there. But we could get quite geeky with all of this, but I think it remains to be seen how it actually rides. Warren has a set, but I don't think like the suspension elements of it are going to be huge a difference to the Fox 32 mountain bike fork. Obviously, the lowers architecture is different.
Yes. Now, Simon, we'll call you. You've only entered the tasting menu of the gravel world. You haven't gone straight to the full three course.
Have you got a posh gravel bike? Because obviously, a tasting menu is often quite posh. Like, you don't go to Nando's.
I don't have a gravel bike at all. Although, all right. I suppose Pete Sampson, who has a gravel TCR, might disagree with me.
Well, that's true.
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I believe that Tom is correct when he says that Formula One cars have suspension. I've not seen one up close, but I believe that is a thing. So yeah, I do think he's right that, you know, suspension generally makes bikes faster. I think the fact that it weighs, you know, 1.3 kilos, whereas a kind of regular fork weighs, you know, I don't know, a gravel fork weighs probably 400 grams. I mean, you know, 900 grams doesn't make much difference even when you're going uphill, so it's probably worth the extra weight if you're riding on kind of really gnarly terrain and you're kind of interested in, you know, especially kind of going downhill fast. I think that kind of, you know, the thing about, there's a small kind of aero benefit from having the, you know, the lower legs of the fork kind of taper off a bit. I mean, yeah, but if you're interested in aero, you know, you're not going to be running a suspension fork like this, because it's kind of ruining that whole, you know, like if you want a kind of aero gravel bike, you're going to get something kind of like the Free T Exploro. And then you're going to kind of use your kind of tire as the suspension system, I imagine, rather than the fork. But I think it's definitely interesting. I think, you know, when I hear that they say, we've designed this gravel fork from the ground up, it's kind of like, well, why does it look so much like a mountain bike fork then? Like, that was kind of my initial reaction to it. And I think, like, there's going to be a lot of kind of, you know, roadie gravel people who, you know, like, for me, if I was buying a gravel bike right now, it wouldn't be one with a suspension fork like this, just because I basically want my gravel bike to be a road bike, which then I take off road. But I'm looking at it from a very kind of narrow perspective. And, you know, if you're a mountain biker and you're kind of used to using suspension and things like that, and you want a bike that is, you know, able to take on kind of technical trails, as it were, which is something that, you know, I don't think I would be interested in doing, then this I'm sure, you know, is going to improve performance massively compared to a rigid fork.
That said, if you're following Tom Marvin's logic, then, you know, Formula One cars, which go on the smoothest roads of all, have suspension. Simon, could the road bike of the future have suspension on it? Or would you, do you scoff?
Yeah, possibly. I think it's a kind of, I think it's an, you know, it's a, probably an underexplored area. I guess the question is do kind of road bikes need it? Like, and you know, obviously we know that, you know, vibrational losses are a thing, but that's generally, you only get those when you're running your tire pressures too high. And obviously with bicycles, we're using the kind of the air spring in your tires as suspension. So as long as you're kind of riding a tire that has enough volume for your, you know, system weight, and you're not bouncing up and down and losing traction, then there's a question of whether that added suspension on top of that is a kind of worthwhile gain if it increases aerodynamic, you know, on a time trial bike, for example, you know, having a fork like this would massively increase aerodynamic drag, and therefore it's going to cost you more time, you know, around a typical time trial course than, you know, having a rigid fork and just lowering your tire pressure 10 PSI.
Just wait until we see gravel time trials come up, Simon. That's what I'm looking forward
to. But yeah, you know, and that's the thing. It totally depends on, on what you're doing. You know, we don't think we're going to see these forks hitting any track bikes soon, but like if kind of, you know, if the gravel UCI series takes off and we start having gravel time trials, you know, like, why not, right? That would be a really interesting category to see how people would, you know, because we know people use aero bars in gravel events, right? So it's clearly possible to do that sort of thing. Like, I think it would be really interesting to see a race organizer try something different like that.
Mm. Now, before we move away from Fox and suspension, Tom Marvin, on the mountain bike side of things, we also saw Fox release a little update to its 36 Enduro-E trail fork. What's the key details on that one?
I did see an update to it. The biggest update, I believe, is a new crown, which has a larger steerer tube overlap. So more steerer tube in the crown, which is there. Basically, it's going to improve durability and sort of keep things a little bit stiffer. And obviously, if you have better overlap, you can also, in theory, drop a little bit of weight. And they reckon they've saved 20 grams.
20 grams?
Yeah.
Stop press.
Whoa. Yeah. I mean, that pretty much is, there's probably more than 20 grams worth of paint on the fork. But hey, 20 grams is 20 grams.
Hmm.
It wasn't a huge update. It was a mid-life cycle update. We don't expect to see a brand new fork from Fox for another year or two. Little running changes here and there.
Nice. Yeah. Did you know I only recently discovered, follow this very good Instagram account called Sterling Bike Doctor, and I came across it first because he has this quite torture chamber-like contraption for removing stuck seat posts. But he quite...
Glorious content.
Oh, it's fantastic content. But he quite regularly replaces steerers and forks. I had no idea that steerers were a pressed-in component in a crown. I always assumed they were sort of permanently bonded or kind of cast, well, not cast, but you know what I mean, like part of the crown, essentially. And yeah, he quite often will convert modern forks to straight steerers or add longer steerers.
Really?
Yeah, really, that's really worth a follow. I don't think it's something Fox would necessarily encourage, but nonetheless, it is a thing that's possible.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the steerer crown interface is known for creaking, certainly after a year or two's use on longer travel forks. I know a couple of people who've had their steerer tubes repressed.
Mm.
There are some forks where it isn't integrated. Generally in lighter weight forks, but
there we go.
An interference fit.
Press fit, hey?
It could be press fit, it could be interference fit. There's all sorts of different levels in the engineering world, but write in and let us know which it is if you actually know
rather than speculating.
You make them threaded, right? It's easier for mechanics.
Now, why not? You know what? I'm not going to keep you in suspense any longer. Tom Marvin, you're absolutely desperate to talk about this one. The Lauf Seigler. Seigler. All new, updated, suspension-tastic gravel board from our favourite Icelandic brand. Tom, over to you. What is the scoop?
Well, so Lauf have a new gravel race bike called the Seigler. It is an evolution of the True Grit, which certainly our North American gravelisters will be quite familiar with. It's a very popular bike over there.
Mm.
It isn't. So a couple of years ago, we ran a story about some patents that
Lauf has on
leaf sprung rear suspension for gravel. And this isn't that bike. that bike is still in development, but this is the stepping stone between the True Grit and the future coming full suspension bike. It is basically a dropped seat stay gravel race bike with huge tire clearance. So there's room for, I think it was 57C rubber on 700 or effectively 29 by 2.25-inch tyres.
Mm-hmm.
It's one by only. They're using a BB or BSA 73 bottom bracket shell instead of the usual BSA 68, so they've had to get SRAM to build some cranks for them with a longer axle. It uses a very thin but deep chainstay plate where it leaves the BB into the seat stays, which again gives a little bit more clearance, and uses things like thin top tubes at the junction with the seat tube and a slacker real seat tube angle, which projects forward of the BB, so it's not UCI compliant, but it maintains the same geometry as a true grit with a 72.5 degree seat angle, I think. And the idea of that is basically that the seat tube can flex, and it gives you basically 10 millimeters of rear axle to saddle compliance.
Interesting.
And they've done that without using pivots, without using like little pins through seat tubes, without you know, doing anything fancy. It's just the way that the carbon is laid up and the shapes of the tubes and the positions of them.
Two things strike me with that. I mean, first off, that is very interesting, but it's interesting to see a brand put a number to that figure. Like, we will often see bikes across, you know, all disciplines, but they'll say, oh, it's got excellent rear end comfort. So to see Lauf actually quantify that with a claim, obviously, we, you know,
I mean, they measured it.
Well, I believe you measured it.
Yeah, well, they showed us the measuring device. Oh, they got some elastic bands strung between the rear axle and the saddle, and with a little chart on it, and you could watch it bounce up and down, and it showed you how much movement there was.
There you go. Yeah. Well, it's certainly better than just saying it's X percent more comfortable.
It's, their X% is it's three times more compliant than the True Grit.
Interesting. The other thing that struck me from what you said there is that, you know, obviously, us in the beating heart of cycling media, we do tend to see products a little bit earlier than the public. Mm. But generally speaking, it's not as far in advance as you might imagine. So it's quite unusual for a brand launching a new bike to openly admit that they're working on something else. Mm. I think it's a good thing for consumers because they can decide maybe what they want to do. But what was their sort of rationale behind that? Did they give any indication as to why they...
I think the full suspension bike is still a little way off. Mm. And I think they recognise that gravel's moved on since the True Grit was launched. So it has 45, clearance of 45, which, you know, okay, I just noticed actually that the Topstone is also only has clearance for 45 or 50. It's quite narrow, really. Mm. And I think they felt that actually the way gravel was going, that was a compromise that they didn't really need to make. There was also complaints about the True Grit, and you know, it was one of the things I sort of mentioned was that, you know, with a fork up front, you really notice that the back end isn't that compliant. And so they felt that, you know, that there was a stepping stone that was probably very much demanded. And given that the full suspension bike is still years away, you know, you either have a True Grit that's 6 years old and very much long in the tooth and largely irrelevant, or you have a bike that comes in.
any True Grit owning listeners would be like, bike's irrelevant.
I still know, as in like in the context of brand new gravel. Like,
if you own a True Grit, bin it now
and buy a Segler or anything else. But I think, you know, bike life cycles aren't 6 years long, that's where the True Grit would have been.
Thanks, capitalism.
Yeah, true. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why. I mean, it's a very accomplished gravel bike. It's still probably one of the most compliant gravel bikes out there, if their measurements are to be believed. They've measured Trek Checkpoint with the Isospeed coupler. They've measured Topstones, and it sits in between the two. They're very open. So I think they said the Topstone has a bit more compliance, and that the Isospeed has the design, a little bit less. So they're not claiming to be the best, but they're claiming like this is what it is. But they're also... I think it's a very valid thing to have gone under.
I have ridden the Lauf very briefly. I actually did the Roubaix Sportive a few years ago with Ruben. But I haven't ridden the Topstone. I have just ridden the Checkpoint. Mm. And I think there's real merit in these sort of compliance systems. I always thought Isospeed was perhaps a tiny bit gimmicky. But having ridden the Domani, the Checkpoint and the Madone briefly... It's a good old system. It does genuinely work. Yeah. And I would trust you, Tom, in believing that the Segler would also be equally comfortable. What do you think, Simon? How does this bike make you feel? As an uncompromising aero weenie, what do you think about putting 2.25-inch tires on a drop-bar bike?
I mean, that's the max. It comes with 40s. It will come with 45s from stock, and they've sent one test bike with 50s.
We're not looking for nuance here, Tom. We're looking for...
I could still run 23mm course of speeds if I wanted to.
Yeah,
is that
exactly.
What you're
saying? Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I think it's a kind of a cool idea, and it's definitely nice that Lauf have kind of demonstrated that 10 millimeters of travel at the rear, because Jack's totally right. Like, that's something that we'll often hear without a kind of specific number or even any specific evidence. You know, I think Lauf's approach to the kind of fork is also interesting. Yeah, I've not ridden one. One thing I did want to kind of quiz you on was this new BSA 73 bottom bracket. So you know, because this is one of the things that, without wanting to kind of bang on about this subject, but this is one of the reasons why press fit bottom brackets are good, because you then don't have to account for that extra space, and you can therefore, you know, have wider chain stays and more tire clearance without being constrained. But does that mean that you have to have, you know, you can only use that specific crank that's built for it?
So SRAM have got three cranks for it, Force, Red and Rival, including the power meter ones. There are a couple of other brands out there doing a road or gravel crank with an adaptable axle. I think Praxis was mentioned.
Eastern.
Yeah.
Would it work with a mountain bike crank, or would the chainring offset be incorrect?
I think the chainring offset would be not quite right. The other thing that's worth noting, that even with this wider bottom bracket, with the SRAM cranks, the way they're designed, the Q factor is still narrower than Shimano's GRX on a 68, apparently.
There you go. Yeah, fair.
Speaking as someone who's mechanically incompetent,
I once described you as having tatty hands in a article.
A threaded VV, you know, from a lifetime, you know, like from a mechanic in at home point of view, they're much easier.
Yeah, no, I know. Anything that's a kind of like a new non-standard sort of makes me think, isn't that going against the whole point of threaded bottom brackets? But maybe it works. And if more people adopt it, and you're right that, you know, I was kind of thinking, well, you wouldn't be able to run X crank, but if you've got cranks which have a kind of, as you say, a separate axle, then it's just a matter of changing the axle.
I'm sure Rota would do it as well. Yeah. I think their sort of point on that was that, you know, if gravel bikes originated now with a 73mm BB, and then someone bought out one with a 68, everyone would be like, why are you doing that? You know, like it's wider. You can still get your Q factors nice and narrow. It's stiffer. It means more tire clearance. So, you know, like, it's better.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Fair enough.
There is a bike in the shed. I don't know if I've got time to test it before I leave. So you're welcome, more than welcome to jump on it. I'd love you to jump on it and ride it.
Maybe I will.
Yeah, you should.
The shed, by the way, is where we keep all our bikes. Yeah.
A little rickety wooden thing with a padlock on the door.
No, we're not going to tell anyone where it is, though.
Down the back of my garden.
Finally, we're going to have a little bit of a road dessert to finish things off. We're actually recording this just before the race, so perhaps it will be used to great success, and maybe someone from the team will have won using this bit of tech. But earlier this week, we reported that a wireless €3,998 tire pressure control system would be raced at Paris-Roubaix. Simon von Bromley, you brought us the story on this one. Please tell me everything I need to know.
Yeah, so it does what it says on the tin. It basically allows the rider, it's a system that mounts to the wheel hub, connects to the tubeless valve, and allows air basically to flow between the tire and this device mounted on your hub according to the control of the rider. So basically means you can adjust your tire pressures on the go. Now, we kind of don't really have that many details on this product. They've kind of put it on their website. Team DSM are the team who are going to be using it, because they're sponsored by this brand Scope, which is a Dutch wheel company. The UCI have apparently approved it for use, which I think is frankly mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling.
Not because I, you know, am against innovations, but just when we consider the kind of things that the UCI have banned in recent years, like, you know,
doping.
You're not allowed to rest.
Way more fun when they used to allow doping.
Socks.
But you're not allowed to rest your forearms on handlebars, for an example. That was an innovation too far for the UCI. You're not allowed socks that go up past the midpoint of your calf. You're not allowed end caps on wheels that are aero profile. You know, these were all technological innovations too far, but this system, that allows you to lower and raise your tire pressure continuously on the go, is apparently that's fine. And like the UCI press release said, it's fine because it doesn't contain an air compressor. You know, I mean, obviously, because, you know, air compressors are massive. But they also said it doesn't contain any moving parts, which is impossible because it must have valves, which will move according to. So I think it might be one of those things that if it works kind of as advertised, you know, the scope is claiming a 30 watt advantage potentially, because obviously, you know, if you're optimizing your tire pressures for the cobble sections, your tire pressures will be too low for optimum rolling resistance on the tarmac sections. And likewise, if you optimize for optimum rolling resistance on the tarmac sections, your tire pressure will be too high for optimum rolling resistance, comfort and grip on the cobble sections. So most people have had to kind of find a balance. You know, you maybe take a larger tire that gives you more leeway, but you kind of take a risk and say, well, you know, my strategy is I'm going to try and get through the cobbled sections and then have good tire pressures for the kind of, you know, run to the line because I want a time trial away on the tarmac or whatever. Or, you know, if you want to attack on the cobblestone sections or it's wet, then, you know, you're going to optimize your tire pressures for that and then just try and hold on the tarmac sections and assume that everyone else will be doing the same thing. But if you can, you know, continually change your tire pressures throughout the race, then you're not losing, theoretically, not losing anything. Now, I don't know how quickly or slowly this device works because they haven't given any details. But if it works quickly enough to be useful, you know, this could be a huge innovation. And, you know, I mean, it'd be that classic thing where, you know, the UCI has had a tendency to, you know, ban things after they've been successful. So it might be the case that, you know, this team uses it. They don't have any of the major favorites. I think they're kind of best chances with Niels Eckhoff, who won the... I believe it was the under 21 World Road Race Championships before in Yorkshire, but then got disqualified for drafting a team car back to the bunch after a crash. But he's a very useful rider. But otherwise, they don't have a kind of, you know, they definitely don't have a Tom Boonen or a Cancellara type rider. So I suspect they're not going to win and this might die down. It'll be interesting to
see
if
they're listening.
Will
be laughing a lot if he's won on when this comes out.
I mean, if they and but this is the other thing, right? If they do win, you know, and obviously we're like you say, this is going to go out afterwards, and we're recording it before. But if they have won, then everyone will be attributing it to this device, and this poor rider who was, you know, won the biggest race of their career will probably get none of the credit.
I don't quite understand how it works, and I know you don't either, Simon, because that hasn't been explained. But to my mind,
I think I do.
Can I guess then? All I can imagine it happening is either it's got one or two chambers within this thing, and it either releases air into another chamber, at which point there's kind of no point in putting it into the chamber because then it's not going to be able to push that air back in because the air would just release, you know, it'd be at a lower pressure. So one assumes that if you lower pressure, it just expels it out. And then to increase the tire pressure again, it must have a pressurized chamber that's above the tire pressure of the tire that will allow you to feed it in a certain number of times. And if it doesn't have a compressor, as it says, then, you know, you will be limited to whatever the volume of that chamber is until the tire essentially equalizes in pressure with that chamber. The alternative would be that if maybe it has a CO2 canister in it and they're really high pressure. Am I right, Simon?
I think it's something like that. Yeah, like you say, we don't know whether it has a CO2 canister or if it's something, like you say, you kind of have to like pump up so that it's above the pressure and then it can, as you say, it has one chamber that you can take out with and one chamber that would be used to go up. Yeah, they haven't given us anything. You know, we did ask, but
it's quite a bulky thing. Respond. Just looking at the photos, it's not. It's like triple the diameter of a normal hub.
Yeah, it's fairly chunky.
Yeah, there is just a load of 16-gram CO2 canisters in there. Gone to Lifeline and bought a job lot, and
it's very strange. I have to say, like, I like you, Simon. I think innovation is cool. I think this is something that could be really like properly game-changing in a race like Roubaix. I think where I slightly struggle with this is that from a consumer's point of view and the broader market, like, who's going to buy this? Even those dedicated
100%
racer, you know, like, road racers are conservative at the best of times. The idea of putting this thing on would probably be horrifying to many riders, but, like, the use case is so, so narrow. Now, like a bloody great way to get headlines for Scope Wheels. You know, we're all talking about it. We're doing a podcast on it. But like as an actually usable bit of technology, I just don't see the wider applications. And there is actually, you might remember, Tom, from Eurobike some years ago, there is a very similar system for fat bikes. And this is a different one. It's self-charging. It's quite mechanical and uses the rotation of the wheel to add and lower pressure. It's much more agricultural looking than this. And like, that's been around for donkey's years, and I've never seen one in the wild. This is an even more niche application. Would you ever use it in your riding, Simon?
No, and I think, you know, you're spot on, and I had exactly the same thought. And when I did our social post on this, I said, you know, would you spend 4,000 euros to be able to change your tire pressure on the go? And of course, every reply was no. And yeah, for a road racer, you know, most, you know, 99% of road races are not held on terrain where this would be useful.
Yep.
You know, Paris-Roubaix and, you know, other cobbled classics, and, you know, races like Strada Bianca, they're so kind of specialized, and they only really take place in the World Tour. You know, there's obviously the Rutland Classic in the UK.
The Rutland Cycle Classic. Even our own Joe Norledge, formerly of this parish, has ridden that. I could see him using this and that.
but that, you know, that even that event is only open to elite riders in the UK. So I think this is probably has more, you know, more of a home for gravel. And I could see that if you were taking part in a gravel race and you're very serious about that, then, you know, it could potentially offer a similar advantage there, where you could, you know, change your tire pressures as the terrain changes, and, you know, that could be a useful gain. And, you know, gravel racing sector is a growing market, so maybe that's where they kind of see it going. And, you know, partnering with a World Tour team ahead of Paris-Roubaix, as you say, it's a great way to get headlines. And, you know, this has been splashed across every, you know, bike tech website in the world. Of course, you know, the only place you want to read about it is on the best multidiscipline cycling website, bikeradar.com. But, you know, other outlets have covered it.
Looking at it being slightly more generous as well, like 4,000 euros, it's a lot of money. But I remember some years ago, I think it was, they were Team Sky at this point, now Team Ineos, they were running those crazy 3D printed titanium TT extensions, which were like 9,000 euros or something. Now, you know, you can have some pretty serious gains with a well-optimized cockpit on a TT bike. However, like in the context of potential savings, you know, 4,000 euros makes you win Paris-Roubaix, you know, probably quite good value for money.
And I think, and you know, that's the other thing is, obviously I've seen a few comments sort of saying, well, it's so expensive. But if you're a pro team and they sponsor you, you don't have to pay anything.
It's true.
And but yeah, you're totally right. Like, you know, those bars that Ganna uses are, you know, 3D printed by Metron Additive Engineering. You know, those are one-offs and they cost thousands and thousands of pounds. And if you want to change your TT position after that, bin it, get a new one. You know, like this isn't going to stop being useful if you decide you want to optimize your position on the road bike or whatever. Like, or if you change your wheel set, you can just change this across to a different wheel set. It's not even a kind of built-in hub system, though I'm sure, you know, they probably could build it into a hub if they were to refine it. But the fact that it can be transferred between bikes is quite nice. The only thing I would add is that the website and Scope are not clear whether that 3,998 euros is for a set of two, so, you know, one for each wheel, or if actually you only get one of these devices, and then you have to see if you want to control the tire pressure in both of your wheels, and you actually need to spend 8,000 euros. But that would be something. But like you say, at the top of the sport, people, you know, there are teams with big budgets, and if you can get it on a sponsorship agreement, you don't have to pay anything. You know, like you say, you know, winning a race like Paris-Roubaix, for many teams, like, that would be worth the money.
Yeah. God, automatic tire pressure control on road bikes. What a time to be alive.
Magic.
One of the funny comments, a couple of the funny comments we have are like, well, it'd be quite interesting to be able to see your tire pressures live, though. That's a good innovation. And I kind of went in and said, oh, well, you know, that already exists.
Yeah.
You know, you can get a Quark Tire Whiz for $300. And I was reading Seb's review of the Quark Tire Whiz, and he's like, oh, it's a bit expensive.
Well, are we putting disc brakes on road bikes next? My goodness, what a time. Right, we'll finish on a positive note. We're going to go over, we do this in our Monday meetings in the Bike Creator team. We'll bring it to the podcast. Tom Marvin, what's been your highlight from the last couple of weeks on the site? What's been your favourite bit of news, reviews, anything? What have you enjoyed reading?
Oh, crikey, we're going to have to take a little pause here while I have a quick look back through BikeRadar.com.
You've read all of my articles,
have
you, Tom?
I have read all of your articles, yeah, always.
It could be a personal highlight, Tom. You know, you can toot your own horn.
No, I think we've done...
That's what I'm going to do.
I think we've done some good stuff. There's been some good videos on our YouTube channel, actually. There's a whole host of bicycle-related content on there.
Yes, there would be. You would hope so on BikeRadar.com. Are you struggling to recall anything, Tom?
I am not struggling to recall.
Do you want to throw it over to me?
I'll throw it over to Simon while Tom goes through his YouTube, clearly not valuing the contributions of his colleagues to the site. Simon.
My highlight, I'm gonna call out the Specialized S-Works 7 lace shoes, which, you know, it might not surprise you to hear that a very expensive pair of cycling shoes are very good cycling shoes, but I have a real penchant for lace-up cycling shoes, and these are genuinely excellent. I found them incredibly hard to criticize. Now, I know you two have tried the S-Works Recon lace, Tom, and... You know, you, Jack, have tried some other specialized shoes and have found some around the ankle a little bit of initial discomfort. But I didn't even have any of that. I thought the fit is excellent. The laces were great. You know, they've got a kind of aerodynamic profile. You know, very stiff soles. Like, they look good. Like, oh, just a great pair of cycling shoes. The only thing I have with them is I don't know about black cycling shoes. I look down, especially with laces, I feel like I'm kind of, you know, wearing classic cycling shoes, like kind of Eddie Merckx or something, and then other times I feel like I look down and I'm wearing Oxford shoes.
Your little school shoes off to take your packed lunch on a ride. Yeah,
but they are available in white or a kind of coral, but yeah, just genuinely, they were comfortable, they were stiff, they've got an aerodynamic profile. They didn't come with the warp sleeve that the Sub 6 came with, which is a bit of a shame, but that might be released again at some point.
With the what, sorry? The warp?
So the warp sleeve is like a kind of cut-down time trial overshoe that just covered the laces part. It basically gave you the same gains as in a time trial overshoe, but it didn't obviously close off kind of ventilation around your ankle or around the toes. And so it was still kind of warmer, easier to put on, all of that sort of stuff. And it was really, really good idea. And I think they just dropped it because, you know, this new shoe, whilst it shares a lot with the old Sub 6, is now marketed as, you know, the kind of towards the S-Works Aphos crowd rather than the S-Works Venge crowd, who specialized, you know, put on a catamaran and sent off into the sunset.
It's like a swimming cap for your laces. I think that's the way I would describe
it. I like it. Good.
And Simon, you know, you're saying you struggle to criticize them, but come on, how much do they cost?
Well, they cost £300.
Oh,
but most of Specialized latest shoes are £400.
Oh, bargain.
Yeah, bargain.
And the thing is, you know, if you wanted to buy Giro Empire SLXs, or I've got to have a pair of Nimble Air cycling shoes. Those are all more expensive. So
an absolute bargain.
Yeah, £300 is a lot of money, but you know, Shimano S-Fire shoes cost £350 or £325.
Yeah, it's
something
not unheard
like that.
Of,
and
to be fair,
it's not unheard of. And I, you know, in my review, I did say if you're looking for cheap cycling shoes, there are other cheaper lace-up options. I gave a few examples. So
fair enough.
So that's fair enough. And you know, but they don't have the kind of ultra stiff carbon sole that you get on a top end shoe. And you know, whilst the performance benefits of an ultra stiff carbon sole are kind of debatable, as we've shown in an excellent article on BikeRadar.com, I do still believe that they do make a shoe more comfortable.
Yeah.
So for me, I would spend my money on that. And I have in the past, you know, before I was a journalist.
Tom Marvin.
Yeah, my highlights that I was trying to get to before I was rudely cut off. we've just wrapped up a gravel podcast series. A getting into cycling podcast series.
Yes, getting into cycling, your best 2020 year of riding ever.
Yeah, I think some of those were really, really interesting with some great guests that Catherine put together. And we're in the middle of recording a gravel series as well, which has been, I did a couple yesterday, which were super fun to record. And I think that's going to be a really informative, interesting series that, again, our freelancer extraordinaire, Catherine, is presenting and hosting and pulling together. On a personal note, I've just sent to print What Mountain Bike.
Oh, wow. Back from the dead.
Back from the dead for a one-off special edition of What Mountain Bike.
I think you were a What Mountain Biker. This was a former title as part of the immediate Our Media stable. Sadly, the focus moved to MBUK around 2017, 18. And, you know, it's been revived that you've been leading that one, Tom.
I've it's my first ever magazine that I have been editor of. And I'd like to give all the credit actually to the art editor, Mark Rutkowski, who did an incredible job of putting it all together. And I just pulled a few words here and there from various places. And
chased me for a photo I never supplied for,
yes,
actually.
So we ended up having to last minute change an entire DPS spread.
Sorry, Tom.
It's quite all right. But yeah, so that's been a fun journey.
And when will that be hitting newsstands for our UK listeners?
Absolutely no idea. A couple of weeks' time, you'll find it maybe packaged up with MBUK or maybe stood alone in WH Smith's. Who knows? I sort of think I should know.
You should really, yeah. Check it out. It'll be a good one. All the details will be on buy subscriptions on the Our Media page or you can check out the Our Media site in general. I'm sure that info will be on there.
Yeah.
I think for me, my personal highlight, quite a boring one, I'm going to say, but we recently republished an updated guide to electric bike conversion kits. I don't know about you two, cheeky boys, but I feel like on my commutes to and from work, I have seen more and more of dubious quality, I might add at times, electric bike conversion kits, most often duct taped into the main triangle of the frame.
Most often ridden by people with big square rucksacks on their back.
Yes, they're definitely a Deliveroo favourite. But, you know, I have also seen them for just general commuting and... You know, if they're delivering my delicious pizzas by bike, not
absolutely
on a moped.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, there's a lot of bikes in the world and electric bikes, as we've shown through content on site and just generally, you know, how people use them day to day, have a real potential to kind of turn the tide on urban mobility. And, you know, if we can get electric bike conversion kits, which are nearly as good as a proper, you know, ground-up designed electric bike, I think that can only be a positive thing. And off the back of that and the popularity of the piece, we are actually going to do a little group test of them. And I'm genuinely looking forward to seeing the outcome of that because if I had a longer commute and I had a nice bike, it's definitely that I wanted to keep. It's definitely something I would consider.
Do we know who gets the joy of fitting various electric bike systems to their bike?
Not me, Tom.
Hopefully not me either.
No, that's yet to be determined.
Are you going to be testing one of those little two-stroke motors that sits in the sits in the frame center as well?
No, that kind of goes against my general feelings with them. But no, it's something I enjoyed reading about, and anecdotally, it feels like something that's becoming more and more popular in the general buying public. So yeah, look forward to seeing how that one goes. Well, thank you very much to my wonderful colleagues for joining me today. That was a very enjoyable one. If you did enjoy this podcast yourself, please do give us a 5-star rating. It makes a big difference. And if you think there's anything we could do better, of course, do give us any feedback. There will be an article accompanying this piece on bikeradar.com. Do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you very much for listening. We've got a really good couple months ahead on the podcast. We will be taking it. Tom actually normally manages the podcast for the most part, but he's way off on a jolly for a few months. So we will go on valiantly trying to hold a lantern up to your standard.
As we sit here in the studio, our meeting for planning the next few months has literally just started on MS Teams, and our friend Alex Evans is already waiting in the lobby.
Well, we're off to go plan some red hot content. Thank you again for listening. Speak to you soon.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.